There's a particular topic that I wanted to get to cover with those of you here in Jefferson. And I'll give you the title as we go into it. And I've titled this, The Age of Accountability. The Age of Accountability. And obviously, it's important for all, for different reasons, to understand this, I think. But for young people, you have a lot of young people here in this congregation, which is a very, very wonderful thing, you know, to have so many children and teens and young adults that are attending here. We're very thankful for that. But I ask you as a young person, do you ever wonder at what age God holds you accountable for your actions? That if you do something wrong, do you ever wonder, what does God think? How will God address this, so far as me personally concerned? And I'd like to get into this topic, first of all, by asking you to think about, and I'm going to use the term, an awareness. Awareness. We're going to look at two or three different things so far as awareness is concerned. And, you know, we don't often think about the awesome miracle of life. You know, what an awesome thing that God created human life. And you and I are the recipients of that. You live, you exist because of God's good pleasure. You have life. What is life? How do you define life? How do you define consciousness? So I want to ask you, first of all, here, when you first became aware of certain things, and first of all, the awareness of being alive. What were, as you try to think back in your life, what can you remember the first thing that you ever thought of or can think of when you became aware of yourself, your surroundings, or some act that you were doing? How old were you? So 1.5, 2 years? At what age did you become aware of your existence? And to realize that billions of years had gone before that, but there was a time that you suddenly were aware of you, of your existence. Interesting to discuss that if we had time to do that. You know, that, say, what were your first thoughts? What was the first memories that you have here, you know, of your existence? Now, I want you to also think about, and this may be a little more challenging, when was it you became aware of right and wrong? I know sometimes even small children will say, now that's not fair. At what age have you heard your children or grandchildren say that that's not fair? Well, that's an awareness of right and wrong. What they're saying, you know, something is wrong. I'm not being treated fair here. I'm being treated wrong. So you preteens and teens, I'm not just talking, but, you know, to the teens, or, but even the small children, you know, think about this as well. And as we think of right and wrong, sometime after that, perhaps especially those of you who are attending church here, you might begin to wonder if God might hold you accountable for what you do. And so I would ask here, if you have had that thought, at what age were you when you began to think, well, what is God going to think about this? Will God punish me for what I am doing or have chosen to do? I think a lot of young people think about that, maybe just briefly, maybe more seriously. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, I'm not going to go there, I'm going to quote it, most of you know it. But it says there, for you see your calling, brethren, for you see your calling. You see your calling. And so, I would ask all of us, do we see our calling? Now I want to ask you, young people, do you see your calling? Are you aware of it? Every young person here, are you aware of your calling? You ever think about it? And when was it that you became aware? And we could all ask ourselves this as an adult. You know, somewhere along the line, every one of us here probably, to one degree or another, thought, you know, I'm probably being called. I remember a number of years ago, there was a young man that came to my house, and he had a question about, a doctrinal question, and we sat down and talked about it. And I explained the scripture that was a question for him that seemed to be a contradiction of one of our teachings, but I showed him what the scripture really meant. And I said to him, look, if you understand and don't understand, it's going to depend really on whether you're being called by God or not. And he looked at me at that time and said, Mr. Gore, he said, I think I am being called. And he hadn't been attending church very long, but with the very sober expression on his face, he said, I think I'm being called. And so he became aware at that time, somewhere around that time, that he was being called of God. I want to go to 1 Corinthians 7:14. Again, another scripture we're all quite familiar with. And it talks here about, of course, the various types of marriages in the church, some who are both are members, some where the one's a member, one's not, one's a believer, one's a non-believer. And some of these, of course, in most cases occurred before the people came into the church. But, and of course, Paul is saying, look, if you have an unbelieving mate and they're pleased to dwell with you, then you should, you know, retain, work to maintain that marriage. And he tells why here in verse 14. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Whichever way, there's a certain change, something happens in that marriage or that family because of one being converted. You know, that God looks upon that family in a different way because there's a converted individual in that family. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. So here it says the children of a member of members are holy. And I've mentioned this before here, and sometimes our children, or maybe people, can misunderstand that the word holy here doesn't mean righteous. It's not saying here that the children of the members are righteous. It says they're holy. And the word holy here means separate. You know, and certainly they could be far from righteous. We all are not as righteous as we hope to become. But so they've been separated in the eyes of God from the world. That they, because of a converted father, mother, or both, they now have access to the truth. They now have been given an opportunity to read and understand the truth without spiritual blindness. They can understand things that other children and other people cannot understand. You know that, and so that's what it's saying here. It's saying here that you have access to membership in the family or the church of God. They have access to the first resurrection, to have an opportunity to be born into the family of God or participate in the first fruits here. So I would ask you young people, what does it mean to you when you read the scripture? What does it mean to you when you think about, hey, God has made available to me a calling? We're going to come back to that a little later. Do you ever think about that as a young person? You know, and again, some of our preteens. So I especially want to focus on today in this Bible study on young people and their parents as well. And when I say young people, I don't just mean teens, but also all the way down to very small children, because it's very important that parents, you know, help their children to understand, and we'll get back to the question, the age of accountability. The age of accountability. I would say, believe it or not, but I still remember some of the thoughts and questions I had at your age, especially having some knowledge of the truth. I remember that I might do some things that maybe weren't quite right and wonder if God would hold that against me. You know, a little later in my studies and learning, long before I ever became baptized, I had heard of what is called the unpardonable sin. And as, even as a young person, that worried me. Because I wasn't in the church. There was no church close by, not even one within 500 miles. Had no relatives attending. I was, of course, quite young, and yet I heard about this sin, that if you commit a certain sin, you do certain things that are wrong knowingly, that you could cross the line where there'd be no return. You could go over the line, your conscience would be seared, and there was no coming back. And I knew enough, I didn't want that to happen to me, because there'd be nothing ahead but eternal death. And so that thought popped into my mind a lot as a young person. And, you know, facing some of the things, the temptations that face all young people. So with that in mind, let's go to John chapter 9. And you as a young person, again, I'm not just saying only teenagers or young adults, but even our young preteens, you know things that even some adults don't know. You have knowledge that a huge percentage of the people in the world don't have. I remember one of the parents was telling me a few years ago about, I guess it was getting close to Christmas, and they were checking out of a store in line, and somehow, I think maybe when the clerk said, "Merry Christmas," or "Hope you have a good Christmas," and the 6-year-old boy said, "Christmas is pagan." And so he knew it was wrong. I don't know whether he knew the meaning of pagan or not, but he knew that it was wrong at five, six years of age. And as we know that, I don't know her age, but she knows that Christ didn't have long hair. How many so-called Christians know that? We could go through a lot of things like that. But you have knowledge. But knowledge can be dangerous. You know, and the more knowledge we have, you know, we could be accountable for what we know. So let's look at John 9:41. And this, to me, I hope to cover this scripture at another time at a Bible study. It's interesting what it says. The Pharisees were critical of Christ, and he talked about spiritual blindness, and the Pharisees said, "Are we blind also?" And notice Christ's response here. Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see,' therefore your sin remains." Now, obviously, we know we don't take that totally literally here. If you were spiritually blind, you would have no sin. If you took it literally and said, "Well, let's be sure we remain ignorant, therefore we'll never have any sin." Now, you wouldn't have the sin. You wouldn't be held, as we're going to see, you wouldn't be held as responsible as someone who isn't blind. You know, and again, there are several scriptures that, as I said, this is totally another subject, a very interesting subject. But he shows here that because you aren't blind, when you do sin, your sin remains. It's a greater sin than someone that doesn't know. Let's go to chapter 15. Chapter 15, and let's notice verse 15:22. He said, "If I had not come and spoken to you, them, they would have no sin. But now they have no excuse for their sins." You know, so once again, when you've heard the truth, you understand it, God says you have no excuse. Yeah, and of course, the book of Romans, Romans 1, talks about they are without excuse. You know, because there is a certain amount of truth that they know, that they understand. Let's go, finally, another scripture here that corroborates this in Luke chapter 12. In Luke chapter 12. And we're going to read, verse 47. and 48, I believe it is. Let me double check to be sure. 47, 48. Christ said, "And that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know yet committed things deserving of stripes shall be beaten with few. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. Too much has been committed, of him they will ask more." Now, you know, as a young person, think about this. Think about what it's saying. You know, you do know the truth. You do know a whole lot, far more than your classmates, far more than your peers out there. So isn't this telling us that God holds you more accountable than those of the world, you know, because of that knowledge? And that should be sobering. It was to me when I was a young person growing up with the knowledge. Yeah, and we talk about when were you called, some of us that didn't grow up in the church, and when did you become aware of your calling? And I think there are two different times here. When you become aware that you're being called may be one time, but God may have called you long before you became aware of it. And I believe that's true in my case. As I look back in retrospect, I didn't think about it in times past, but the more of the last year or two, I do believe that God chose to call me at a pretty early age. I'm going to say that I believe it's possible that, and some of you probably might say the similar thing, I believe as early as that I was 6 or 8 years of age that God had looked down and said, "I'm going to call him. I will call him." You know, he won't be aware of it for a long time, but I could give a lot of reasons why I believe that. I won't take the time to go into that. But that's when I heard the truth. You know, I first heard the truth when I was 6 years of age, as my parents were listening to the radio broadcast at that time. And my parents and my uncle started listening, and they knew that this was something different. It was the truth of God. And they were very excited about it. And so as us, when the radio was on, you got one radio, no television. And so you listen to what's on the radio. And so we would listen, and I recognized very early that, you know, he said that the Sabbath is the seventh day. Look on the calendar, the seventh day over here is Saturday. So I didn't have to be 21 to understand that. I saw immediately on the calendar that the seventh day was Saturday. And so I understood that. And I believe that, and it, you know, I was very happy to know that, because I knew something others didn't, you know. So that's what you call pride of knowledge sometimes, rather than applying it, which I took me a while to do. I'm thankful for God's long suffering. So I knew only a little. There was no local church to attend for many, many years. And later, as I was older, I began to think about more about my actions. And I think I've shared with you the story of how one time that I wanted to buy a RC Cola. They cost a nickel, and a moon pie cost a nickel, and a bag of peanuts cost a nickel. And so having a nickel was very rare for a lot of us. And so we stopped at the store. It was a school bus. He'd stop every time on the way home. And if you had any money, go out and buy a drink and a bag of peanuts or a moon pie. Well, I walked into the store, and I said to the merchant, I said, "Can I buy this soda pop and pay you later, tomorrow maybe?" He said, "Okay, that's all right." Well, I drank it, and then I either forgot or didn't have a nickel the next day and the next day and the next day, and pretty soon I was ashamed to go back later because I hadn't paid him. And this bothered my conscience. And I worried about it, and I was quite young then, maybe 10 or 12 years of age. And it bothered me for a long time, and I've told you the story. Finally, I had a nickel. I had several nickels one time later, and I said, "Well, I didn't pay him, but there's a nickel that doesn't belong to me. I owe it to him. So I was standing on the front porch of my house, and I threw the nickel out in the field that was next to our house. And so if you want a nickel, I can tell you where to, which field to look in. I don't know if you'll find it or not. But anyway, I've got to appease my conscience. Well, that wasn't the best way to do it, but it was the way that I chose at that time. But I did worry at times about how much was I accountable to God for, you know, the things that I did. So I would ask again, any of you young people, think about that. And we know that probably your parents have told you from time to time, you know, you're old enough to know better than that. Any of your parents ever told you that? You're old enough to know better than that. What's wrong with you? Well, is there an age that God begins to judge you, to hold you accountable? From what I've read, the Mormon Church believes that 8 is considered the age of accountability. You know, that's their belief, according to what I've read. Some say that the age of 12, and say, well, why do they say 12? Well, 12 was when Christ was, they say, was went into the temple and was discussing, you know, religious principles in the temple with some of the teachers of that day. Probably most of you have heard of bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah. You know, the Jews have what is called a bar mitzvah. And this takes place at the age of 13. And that's when the Jewish boys make a transition into what might be called the beginning of manhood. But what does bar mitzvah mean? The word bar, when you see it in the Bible, means son. The girl is bat. Bat mitzvah. They do have a bat mitzvah as well. Bar mitzvah. Bar means son, and mitzvah means commandments. So he becomes a son of the commandments. And so the Jews teach that at the age of 13, he's held accountable for his actions. Now, where they came up with the age of 13, I am not sure. Now, so we're talking about the age here. And it is a question a lot of people have. Some churches believe that Adam's sin was passed on to all humans. You know, that's a teaching. You know, the sin of Adam, that it's genetically passed on to all. It's a twisting of one of Paul's scriptures there in Romans, of course. So the stain of Adam's sin. And so they teach that babies are born sinners. So the Catholic Church baptizes babies to erase that, you know, inherent sin. I know I was attending the Methodist Church, and they were encouraging young children to be baptized, normally around the age of 12. Again, it's that get rid of that stain of Adam's sin. But we know that's wrong. You know, that's not right. But these are what some of the people say about the age of accountability. What does God say? Let's go here. It's an interesting comment that's made in the book of Isaiah. In fact, a couple places in Isaiah. Let's notice Isaiah 8. We'll go there first. It doesn't say a whole lot, but it shows something about there are things that happen as you age. And there are a couple of prophecies here that, and one is that about Isaiah and his wife having a baby. And as he's predicting the punishment of Judah and Israel, and God said, I want you to call his name, and it says, Maher Shal al-Hashbaz, which, you know, translated was a prophetic name. But I want to look at Isaiah 8 and verse 4. He says, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria, those were the two nations' capitals that were attacking Judah, will be taken away before the king of Assyria. So here he shows that there's a certain time that a baby reaches the age that they can say, Dada, 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 Mama. And so here we show, we see shown here that the progression of understanding of knowledge. But let's drop back to chapter 7. In chapter 7, we have a dual prophecy of a child being born during Isaiah's time, and it is dually speaking not only of the child at Isaiah's time, but looking forward to the birth of Jesus Christ as well. But I just want to look at a point made here. We'll look at Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 and 15. It says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with you. Now notice verse 15. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse evil and choose good. Now the word "that" can be translated "until." And so it shows here that here, curds and honey were a part of the diet of a baby that was, you might say, being weaned. And so it's speaking of a very young age here, but it's interesting that it uses a baby or a child there that's beginning to understand the difference between right and wrong here, that to refuse evil and choose the good. Of course, that's the goal that we want for our children as well as for ourselves too. So we have this interesting comment that's made here. I'd like to read it in the Bible in basic English. It says, "Butter and honey will be his food when he is old enough to make a decision between evil and good." So it's showing here that there's a certain age that young people or children even begin to recognize that there is evil, there's good, and of course, as a part of those who understand, would want to choose good. That's what God would want. Here, I'll just quote here from Proverbs 20, verse 11. It says, "Even a child is known by his deeds, whether what he does is pure and right." So we have, as I said here, a lot of young people here in Jefferson. I was thinking of the names of the young people here, and I'm going to read them here. I'm going to ask you to stand. But we have Matthew, Noah, Ian, the McClellan children, Tegan, Jacob, Aaron, Sam, Grace, Abelin, Kara, Kaysen, Malone, Kingsley, and we could go through others as well. You know, these are our young people. These are the ones that are going to be hopefully thinking about, you know, when does God hold me accountable for what I do, for what I think, how I conduct my life. Yeah, I've said before to young people that I wish in some ways that our young people could travel to some of the third world countries. I've had the blessing of going to Nigeria, the Philippines, Zimbabwe, Malawi, South Africa, as well as, you know, of course, France and England. But if our young people could go to some of these places like Nigeria, the Philippines, you know, Zimbabwe and Malawi, you would be a lot more thankful for what you have. And you know, sadly, all of us do not give as much thought as we should to the blessings we have in this country. And you as a young person don't give it as much thought as you should. Not only the blessings of our nation that we were born into, but also of your family. I remember a number of years ago, you know, as you know, my wife and I had four children. My son was the oldest one. And my son kind of had the habit, about time I wanted to go to bed, he would come up and want to talk. You know, I was sleeping, I think it's time to go to bed, and suddenly he'd walk in the door in the living room and he'd sit down and want to talk. I remember one time that he came in, he had a very sober look on his face, and he said, "Dad," and he began to talk to me about one of his classmates. It was a girl. I think he was probably a junior in high school. And he told me about this girl at school that he knew. And he said, "You know," I said, "Dad, she, her parents kicked her out of their home. And so her boyfriend's parents said she could come and live with the boyfriend's parents. So she moved in with the boyfriend's parents." I said, "Dad, now they're kicking her out." And he said, "Where is she going to live? What's she going to do?" And he was very sad. He thought of this girl and, you know, what she was facing. And I realized, like many young people, and like myself, At one time, I didn't realize that every home was not like his. You know, I grew up and I thought all the parents were like my parents. And I think my son didn't realize that he lived in a stable, loving home and he thought everybody else did. And suddenly he was hit with a shock that a lot of people don't have a home like this. A lot of people don't have parents like this. And it bothered him. It sobered him. It made him think differently. And he's expressed to me a number of times since then how much he appreciates the home that he grew up in. Some of you, most of you know that he later grew up and married the daughter of an elder in the church. And they adopted six children. They worked as foster parents first. They'd take a few children in their home as foster parents. And some of the first two that I remember was an African American boy and girl had the same mother but different fathers. And there were foster parents to them. And they told about the time that they drove away and leaving these two little children, very, very small, in a home. And they told about those two children standing at the window, barely looking over the edge of the window with a sad look on their face as Dan and Beth drove away. And they looked back and they saw their face and they said to each other, "We've got to adopt those children, make them our children." And they did. They adopted them. And later they adopted two more. And then they heard about some children in China. And so they made arrangements to adopt a little girl in China. And so Beth flew to China to an orphanage over there. And there was a little girl there that had been found in the woods. Because in China, the families didn't want girls in most cases in the family because the girls couldn't take care of them when they got old. So they wanted boy babies. And they put the girl babies out in the woods to expose them, let them die out there to wait for a boy baby to come along. And this girl was found before she died. And they brought her to the orphanage. And so Beth went over and adopted her. She had some deformities in her face that added to the problem, I guess, for the parents too. And they named her Zoe. And the word Zoe means life. Well, they had her for a while, and then they got a call several years later. It was from the fire department. They said, "Look, there was a little baby boy left on the doorsteps of the fire department." And said there was a 16, 18-year-old girl from, I think it's Nicaragua, I'm not sure, some South American country. And they said, "This boy, this little baby boy, is just a few weeks, maybe a few months old, and he's paralyzed from here down. We don't expect that he'll live very long, but could you take him in for a few weeks?" And they said, "Well, sure, we'll take him in." Well, they took him in, and they've had all kinds of struggles with him, but he continued to survive. He would be near death a number of times. Of course, his name is Manny. Some of you have seen Manny on the Facebook pages, but he's 13 years of age now. And I think I told you the story when I was down in Atlanta. He asked me to come in, down in Florida, to come in and talk with him. And he asked me if I had ever built anything. It was I a builder. And I told him, yes, I'd helped build some things. He asked his grandma's chair where it used to be. And I said, "Yeah, it's still there." And he said, "Is it on your right?" And I said, "Yes, it is." So he's very sharp and he can use his hands or fingers just a little bit. So you know, he uses tablets to do research and all. But these were foster children. And this is just a few of millions of foster children. I ran across this a while back. It is a letter from a foster child in Oklahoma. And this foster child in Oklahoma was asked what they wanted in a family. And so this child wrote down what they wanted. Let me read it to you. "Things I want in my family. I want food and water. Don't hit on me. A house with running water and lights. I want love. Mom and Dad, don't fight. I want no drugs. Don't kill my pets. Help with school. Nice clean clothes. No lice, no bug in house. Clean house. Clean bed with covers. Don't sell my toys. Treated fair. Don't get drunk. TV in house. Let me keep my games. School stuff. Nice shoes. My own comb. Soap. Nice house and safe. Air conditioner and heater. Coat. Toothbrush. That's what this child wanted. That's what they didn't have. That's what they were born into. What were you as a young person born into? Where were you born? Did you have a choice? Did someone come to you before you were born and said, what kind of parents would you like to have? What kind of home would you like to live in? What country would you like to be born in? None of us were given that choice, were we? We just happened to be born where we are. You didn't choose your country. You didn't choose your parents. But you're tremendously blessed. But do realize you didn't earn it. You did nothing to deserve it. Think about that and be thankful. Let me give you some things to think about as we look at this question that might be on your mind. Perhaps some things that might help as you face the choices, the decisions that you make in your life. 1 John 2:15 says, love not the world, nor the things in the world. Don't love the world. Like us as adults, you have to live in it, don't you? You must live in the world, but not be a part of it. And not let the world dictate your choices, your lifestyle, or your motives. And I want to say here that it's very important for parents to help their children in these two or three points that I am speaking of here. Help them stay separate from the world. Along with that is, and there's another scripture, I won't turn to it, it says, don't seek the praise of men. It's very normal to want to be liked by other people, to be admired by others, even your peers out in the world. I want to say you young girls are more sensitive to this, I believe, than the guys are. So the young girls are more vulnerable. If I remember the statistics, and it's sad that suicide rated very, very high in the deaths of young people. And a lot of it goes back to what we're talking about right here. The sensitivities, and again, parents must help their young people, you know, the sons and daughters, but especially the young girls, because certainly it hurts to see others look down their noses at you and make snide remarks about your clothes, your looks, or whatever it might be. And so you'll be pressured or pulled into acting and dressing like them so they won't do that, so that they will compliment you. Again, it's important for our parents to see this need in their children and especially in their daughters, to give praise and to build up in the right ways their self-esteem and their self-respect, and if necessary, at times as well, to apply tough love. We had three daughters. My wife and I had three daughters. And when they were just starting their teen years, and I've mentioned this before as well, but it ties in here. My wife would bring my daughters and say they're going to special occasion like Sabbath service or something, and they'd be dressed, and she'd bring them into the office where I was and says, look at their dresses. Do you feel it's appropriate? They're appropriately dressed. Are they modest in the way they're dressing? And she'd have the girls turn around in front of me. And she knew, my wife knew, that boys or men look at girls differently than they look at themselves. And she wanted them to grow up to be modest. She wanted them to grow up without scars of mistakes they'd made in their lives. To be very, to be someone that would be rightly dressed appropriately in the eyes of others and God as well. And I finally told my wife, your daughter's getting older. I said, look, it isn't necessary to do that. I will say something if I feel it's wrong, but don't embarrass them. I don't want you to embarrass them in front of me, this way. And I assure you, my daughters are not scarred by the, the conservative approach about their dress, their conduct. Some of you know our daughters. They're very balanced. They're happy ladies now. And I have an excellent relationship with them. So I'd say it's very, very important for the parents to be aware of these pulls for our young people, beginning at an early age, and to protect them from themselves. They don't have the experience, they don't have the wisdom, they don't have the age to see the dangers that they themselves can get into, the choices that they might make. It's important for fathers to be strong for your children's sake and for your daughters. There's some very good books on the importance of a father in the life of his daughter. And, so both parents have a very big responsibility with all, but especially the father and his relationship with the girls. Let's go to the Song of Solomon. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of verses here. As I said, we had three daughters. And if you've had more than one child, the children are different. Even though they grew up from the same parents, the same home, they can be very, very different. And our three daughters were all different from each other. And when you see the differences, you learn how to rear them differently. In a sense, how you work with them differently, how you handle them differently. Some are more sensitive than others, and some are more careless than others. And I could tell you that I knew that there was one of my daughters that wasn't as careful about things as she should be. And I knew that I'd have to keep a closer watch on her. I'd have to have stronger rules from her. One of my daughters, she'd go out on, and this was when she'd go out on a date, and on Saturday night she'd come to me, and it was a boy in the church, and they were, they loved ballroom dancing. But she'd come to me and says, Dad, what time do you want me in? And the other one didn't ask that. But I'd say, well, I'd like you, and I'd tell her what time I wanted to come home. Well, about 30 minutes before it was time, she'd call, and the phone would ring. It might be 11:30 at night, and she said, Dad, we're getting ready to come home. And this was consistent with her. But there, as I say, and I'm not going to tell you the ones that were not, but there are differences. And I want to read just a couple of verses here, and it shows in the Song of Solomon, which is about the intimate relationships between a man and his wife, the physical, sexual relationship, and this beautiful woman that's marrying the king, and this beautiful woman says, I have a sister that she's about to enter into puberty. How do we treat her? And so here's what is said here, verses 8 and 9. Says, we have a little sister. She has no breast. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she's spoken for? What do we do in preparing her for her future, that she will enter into marriage without a lot of scars and memories that will hurt her relationship with her future husband? And so here was the answer that was given. If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. If she's a wall, if she's cautious herself, if she's very concerned how she conducts herself, then we will build, we'll fill her with attractive things to make her attractive. But if she is a door swings open too easily. If she's a door, if she's careless, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. And so it's saying if she's careless, then we're going to watch her more closely. We're going to not be as free to let her do things because she doesn't realize how she will hurt herself. So it's our responsibility to treat her depending on how she acts herself. I talked about long hair. I know that used to be a real problem in the church, and I've had some of the young guys, so many of them back many, many years ago, wanted to have long hair, and they'd come and say, well, now look, the Nazarites didn't cut their hair. Well, most Nazarites is only for a month. And they said, they had long hair. I said, okay, if you want to be a Nazarite and you want to, spend time really doing without anything of the grape, it's not just hair, but it's studying the Bible and really getting close to God and praying as a Nazarite. If you decide you want to take the Nazarite vow, that's okay. We'll let you grow your hair long. But it's not just about hair. It's about a lot of other things as well. And of course, Christ later said, not the vow, but let your yea, be yea, nay, nay. So, but anyway, let's see, where was it? Oh, yes. Sometimes our kids will say to us, well, you don't trust me. And I've had my children say that, daughters, not very often, but I'm sure they did. And I tell people and I say to them, if they say you don't trust me, I don't say, oh, I do trust you. I just want you to be careful. And I say, Dad, you don't trust me. You're right, I don't trust you. I don't trust you because I don't trust me. I don't trust myself. Why should I trust you? I know that we all have pulls and desires that could get us into trouble. I have to stay close guard on my thoughts and my actions as well. And so if I don't trust myself, why should I trust you as a young person? And so for that reason, I want to help you. I've heard talk shows where the subject such as this has come up, and a lot of women called in and they'd say how much they appreciated that their parents or their father set strict rules for them. At the time, they didn't appreciate it. But later in life, they understood. So let's go to Luke 21, verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34. And this is talking about the time of the end, but it has a principle here that ties in with what we're covering here. He says, Luke 21, verse 34, talks about the end time, and he tells his disciples things that are important for them to be aware of. I'm sorry, I'm in Matthew 21. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Okay. 34. Take heed to yourselves. What does take heed mean? It means be careful. Be on guard. Beware. Be on guard to yourselves, lest your heart be weighed down. And it goes on to say some of the traps you could fall into. But I just want to focus on about four or five words here. Lest your heart be weighed down. I'd like to tie this in with conscience. Things that can affect your heart, your conscience, your decisions, your choices. And let's go to Ecclesiastes 12. Because, again, Solomon wrote this, and he understood being young. He understood, the pulls that young people have, the things they look forward to. And so he's going to say here that having fun, having a good time can be all right, but it also, if you're not careful, you'll become weighed down with things that are on your conscience later and memories that you wish you didn't have. Obviously, you're only young once, and You want to enjoy being young, and we want you to enjoy being young before the burden of being an adult falls on you. But notice Ecclesiastes 12:1 says, remember now the Creator in the days of your youth. So while you're having fun, don't forget God. Don't forget God before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure. And while the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are not dark and the clouds did not return after the rain and the days when the keepers of the house tremble and so on. So he shows here that remember God as you are enjoying being a young person. But do realize there are things that can scar or jeopardize your relationship with God and even jeopardize your eternal life in setting you on the path of sin. You know that. So all of us, and you as a young person, do realize that all of us are going to have to stand before the judgment seat of God. I won't take the time because there's some other things I want to cover here. But in Ezekiel 14, there's something it talks about the children of righteous, of the righteous. There are hard times coming that are going to affect both the young and the old. You've heard of a place of protection for the membership of the church. How will you make it through those hard times as a young person, or maybe as a young adult or teenager? You might say, well, if my parents are in the church, I'll be protected with them. But Ezekiel 14 says, no, as you get older and older, teenager, or young adult, you're on your own before God. And you can read that, as it's mentioned 3 or 4 times in the book of Ezekiel. Now, I gave this Bible study because about 5 or 6 teens and young adults last Sabbath. And someone said, well, it was a lady attended there with us, the study, and then attended with another group. She said, maybe I missed it, but what was the age of accountability? I said, well, I'm getting to that. She said, oh, I thought you had said it and I had missed it. So let's get back to that question, the age of accountability. I want to answer the opening question with a different answer. Because people mature at different ages, don't they? Even young people, some are more mature at a young age than others. Some are more sensitive by nature than others. So rather than trying to figure out the age of accountability, but I want all of us and you young people to understand an unfailing law. That unfailing law is mentioned in Galatians 6. And I think it addresses the question that I brought up at the beginning of this message. Let's go to Galatians chapter 6. And I want to read 2 verses here, verses 7 and 8. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. You can laugh at God, you can laugh at His word if you want to, but He is not mocked. For whatever man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. This is an unfailing law. And it is a law that applies to all ages. And I will show that as we go forward. So what you sow, you'll reap. You'll either reap corruption, you'll reap destruction, you'll reap ruin. That's what it's saying. If you sow to the flesh, if you make horrible, bad decisions, you can't avoid it. It's like a stick has two ends. One is the choice, one is consequences. You can't just pick up a stick and the other one stays on the ground. You pick up both. It's true of young and old. So there are natural laws that affect us no matter what age. And likewise, if we break them, there are consequences. It's the natural law, it's a moral law, and there are divine laws. I'll give you an example, and there are many I could give. There are churches who don't know the truth about most things, but there are churches that understand the truth about tithing. And those churches, and I could name the name of one, I won't, because of tithing and knowing that law, they tithe and they're blessed. The members overall are very blessed because of obeying that one law. You know, and so, and just as a principle, you know, what's a moral law, what's a natural law? Let me ask you this as a young person. At what age does the law of gravity come into effect? You know, that, is it 8 or 12 or 13 that the law of gravity comes into effect? At what age did the law of, what is it, thermodynamics, whatever it is, that when mother or father says, don't touch the stove, you burn yourself, he said, well, I'm not of the age of accountability yet, I'll go ahead and touch it. What age does it burn you? Does excess alcohol or drugs affect a young person? Again, you know, you could go on and on. So it's the law of what you sow, you'll reap. Sow good things, you reap good. You're blessed. I said before, your life and death, blessing and cursing, therefore choose. God wants to bless you. He wants to bless us. Let me give you an example of potholes in the highway. You ever run over a pothole? A big one in the highway? You know, sometimes we do, and it'll knock the alignment steering out of the car. And the car will start pulling. I had a car, my first car was crashed into a ditch. It cost me $35 to talk my dad out of not junking it. But it went down the road like this. It was always pulling to the right. So whenever I got somewhere, my arm was tired because the car was pulling to the right. Well, young people, there are a lot of spiritual potholes out there. And they can cause serious damage. Just as they can ruin a tire, the alignment, they can knock your alignment out and cause you to get off the right road. Those potholes want to take you off the road into the ditch, and that's true spiritually. So it's very important, young people, that your conscience is right with yourself and with God. That you have peace of mind. And it's lacking in many out there in the world. It's important for parents to instruct and teach and be an example of following the right choices, the right decisions. Not only just teach it, but be an example of them as well. I brought with me, I don't think I have time to get into those, but there's a book written about values clarification. You know, you as a young person, as you get older, you become your own person. You have to determine your own values. How will you choose what will be your values? And this book has its own values clarification. Because, you know, your values determine your principles, which determines your behavior. And it has 7 steps to arriving at your values, whatever they might be. The choosing of your beliefs, your behavior. And I'll just mention them. I wish I had time to expound on them. But one is option exploration. Option exploration. You explore your options. You have the freedom. Someday you face the freedom to choose. You know, do I choose the same one my parents have? I'm sorry, but don't have time to get it. But it's exploring which options you want for your values. Number 2 would be consequence count. What will happen if I choose this or this or this? 3rd is free choice. Do I really want it? I'm not coerced, I'm not pressured, I'm not bribed. Or am I? Peer pressure can be a pressure to choose your values. Number 4 is accent on the positive. That is, you've made your choices, and now you're feeling and coming to believe that I made a good one, and I'm cherishing my beliefs. Number 6 is values actions. So I've made these my values. How do I translate my values, my beliefs, into the way I live? And they have in the book what is called, it's called pattern building. What can I do and do and do and do? We're just talking about habits. It becomes a way of life. They also have in their, housetop shout, which is at times you share your values with others. You're not ashamed of them. But anyway, it is an interesting discussion. Let me conclude by saying, I hope you all, and I hope you as parents, that even when they're very, very small ones, you help the young ones to think about right and wrong. That they will understand that it's important to feel bad when you do wrong. That guilt can be a good thing. It can lead to change in the right way. It can help us avoid bad choices and, of course, the consequences that come with them. So you as a young person, you sit here today, wherever you are, as a young person, and you've been called, you've been invited, but you have a choice. You have a choice about even whether to respond to that invitation or not. You can accept that invitation that is in your lap to pursue it or not pursue it. You can say, I don't want that in my life now. I want to do my own thing. I don't want to be with the church. I don't want to follow that. And I've told people that you can be in the class in the future, in the second resurrection. You can sit in the class with Britney Spears, or you can be her teacher, whichever you want to do. So do realize that the real answer to the question is just remember that what you sow, you'll reap, and I hope that you reap good things.